Today on Off Mic, we get the latest on the pandemic in Northwest Indiana with rising COVID-19 rates and a call for the state to set up a free testing site. We hear from one local official on his town's plans to host a parade this weekend. And we pay tribute to our nation's birthday with a couple of renditions of our nation's national anthem. And we talk to a local journalist about his book on Hammond history. All this on Off Mic.
Can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming?
Y sus franjas y estrellas en el rudo luchar sobre recio baluarte gallardón ondulaba y la bomba lanzar su rojiza explosión en la noche dio a que allí estaba el pendón estrellado, tremó la feliz.
Let us march on. until victory is won. Now, God of our wearies, God of our silent tears, Thou who has brought us thus far on our way, Thou who has by Thy might led us into the light, keep us forever in the path, we pray. Has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us. Facing the rising sun of our new day. March on till victory is won.
This is Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. That, of course, is Lift Every Voice and Sing, considered the Black National Anthem, as sung by B.B. Winans. Before that, you heard the Star-Spangled Banner, the official national anthem for America, sung by Boyce Avenue. In that, you also heard the national anthem sung in Spanish by Jeremiah Rios. That is the official Spanish language translation as commissioned by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1945. Amazing. Of course, tomorrow is 4th of July, our nation's birthday. The ongoing pandemic has forced the cancellation of many parades and fireworks in Northwest Indiana, but not everywhere. Valparaiso, South Haven, and Griffith plan to have parades this weekend. Here is Griffith Town Council President Rick Rifa talking about his town's parade that kicks off at noon on Saturday. Griffith appears to be one of the few towns in Northwest Indiana that is still having a parade. What kind of parade are you having? Is it pretty much going to be the same, or how's it going to be?
Very similar to parades we had in the past, except there'll be a lot more precautions as the entrants are lining up for the parade. We obviously will ask that they social distance, use every precaution. We're please, if anybody is sick, stay home, whether you're in the parade or visiting the parade. We don't need any issues with that at all.
And is it just as a way to sort of give people a sense of sort of normalcy this year?
I think this is real good for the psyche of everyone. It won't be a super densely populated parade. It's about a mile-long route, and I think it's great for people to get out there. It has been shown in many studies, and even our governor of Indiana stated yesterday that the likelihood of coronavirus being contracted outside is 19 times less than inside. So we're still encouraging everyone to be safe, practice your distancing, and wear masks if you can't.
Will there be like sort of the typical floats or marching bands, or is anything like that not going to be there this year?
Unfortunately, with the schools being closed, the marching bands were not able to participate. So we've improvised a little bit. We do have an alumni band from Griffith High School that the band director from this high school has put together. And we also will have an ensemble band. It's kind of a big band. They'll have some members of their ensemble will be on the top of a flat top, and we'll have a generator with the music and keys and all sorts of good stuff.
Wow. Is there any plans for like fireworks in the evening?
We had planned on trying to put a fireworks show on, but we thought it's best because it would be very difficult for us to control any crowds if we didn't have an event going on. Originally, we were planning on having an event on July 4th. that would include a fireworks show. We have canceled the event, and there, I think it's best that we just cancel the fireworks because at least during the event, we would have control of the crowd, the size and everything. But otherwise, we just don't want to take any chances.
All right. And so the parade is at noon on Saturday, and it's on Broad Street?
Yep, it's on Broad Street. So it would be starting at Ash, which is just south of 45th, and it will be ending on Main Street, which is in downtown Griffith. So I encourage anybody who comes out, please stop at our establishments. I believe they will all be open, and they'd be happy to serve everybody as well to get it in out of the hot air, too.
And you asking people to wear a mask at this parade?
If you can't social distance, we're asking to please wear a mask.
And that was Griffith Town Council President Rick Rifa. And with the pandemic, there is still concern about rising rates of COVID-19 in Northwest Indiana. Dr. Mika Pollack of Indiana University Northwest in Gary has been tracking the latest numbers, and I got a chance to speak to him about that this week. So let me ask you some of the latest numbers that came out today with COVID-19. You're kind of seeing that there's like a slight increase. What are you seeing in terms of, do you see percentages increasing? Is there anything that's causing you to have some concern?
Yeah, so we were doing really well. Just like the state, we kind of peaked in terms of daily new cases back on the beginning of would have been May. And since then, cases have been mostly declining in Northwest Indiana. About 2 weeks ago, the daily cases started increasing, and we went from kind of a low of about 30 or so new cases per day on average over a course of a week to today we're around 65 new cases, almost a doubling of the daily number of cases in the last 2 weeks.
What do you think this might have to do with either increased testing or people just, out and about and not protecting themselves?
Well, it's tough to say. I mean, I think we definitely have kind of reached a sense of complacency with this, and you see more people out and about. There definitely seem to be fewer people wearing masks. And at the same time, I think there's something nationally going on as well, as you read about, kind of the record cases in places like Texas and Arizona. So the spread may be accelerating a bit nationally. We may be kind of feeling some of that being so close to Chicago as we are.
And what are we seeing in terms, I know last week the Indiana State Department of Health talked about how it seems like young people are starting to get it more and more. Are we seeing that over here too?
Yeah, so there's a lot more test positive among younger people, especially those under 40. And it's not clear really if it's spreading more quickly amongst them and what I think is more likely is just younger people are more inclined to go get tested, and it's easier to get tested. It used to be that you had to be high risk. You had to, shown evidence that you were with someone that might have had it. But now pretty much anyone can just, go and get a test for free. And so that's giving us a much broader testing base for young people. And so I think, a lot of these positives would have been there before with young people, but we just haven't seen them. But at the same time, the positive rate is going up. And so that suggests there are also more cases out there that we're not detecting.
And what are you going to be looking for in the coming days, do you think, or in the coming weeks or so in terms of just what number are you keeping an eye out for?
So what I usually look at on Twitter is the number of new cases on average in the last week. Controlling for any day-to-day variation across the week. And that number has been going up for the last 2 weeks. It's doubled in the last 2 weeks, which isn't a good sign. The last time it kind of rose that quickly was back at the beginning of the pandemic. So that's the first piece, which is the number of new cases per day. Then the other thing I look at is the percentage of tests positive, because this gives you an idea of how many cases are out there that we're not detecting. Right? If you have 50% of your cases that you're testing come back positive, then you're probably missing a lot of other cases. If you only have 1% come back positive, you're catching most of them. So here in Northwest Indiana, we're sitting at 6.4% of our cases are coming back positive, which is up from 2 weeks ago was under 5. So that's a little concerning. Even though we're testing the same number of people, a larger percentage of those people are coming back as positive, which suggests that there are more cases out there that we're not capturing and we need to do probably more testing.
And that is Dr. Mika Pollack. Those concerns about rising rates is why Indiana State Representative Earl Harris is asking the state to place a permanent free testing site in either Gary, Hammond, or East Chicago. And this is what he had to say. So tell me, today, obviously, Governor Holcomb has his weekly update about COVID-19. And we are seeing rates going up in Northwest Indiana. Tell me about, you have a concern about a lack of testing sites in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, when you look at Lake County, as you just pointed out, you know, numbers are going up, and Lake County has the second highest number of positive cases and deaths in the state. And you have the fact that we are right there on the state line, you know, so we have a little bit of influence in terms of Chicago and Illinois, et cetera. It's a concern that we don't have a permanent Optum, Indiana State Department of Health site, and this is something that has been brought up. There have been temporary sites, as in this past weekend, there was a temporary site at one of the schools in East Chicago at Cary Gosch, but that's not permanent. So that's a concern for myself, as well as I've heard from a lot of constituents.
Right. And, why do you think the state just, I mean, is it because they're not as fully aware of the situation of Northwest Indiana, or they're just not in tune, or just why do you think there's always this sort of lack of attention put on this area?
You know, I can't give a concrete answer. I really don't know, because I don't, you know, live in other people's brains. But we have brought this up. There was actually yesterday, the Black Caucus had a meeting with the governor. And at the end, all of us had a chance to comment on things. And that was one of the things I commented on and requested verbally, is a permanent site, preferably in either East Chicago, Gary, or Hammond, where there's permanent testing that's free and anyone can come, not just someone that thinks they're showing symptoms, but, you know, you can obviously have it and not show symptoms. So we want a permanent site in the area. So we have made a verbal request. And then I am in the process of finalizing a letter to the governor, a more formal request to put a site in the Lake County, and again, either East Chicago, Gary, or Hammond.
Again, Representative, why do you feel a site like this is needed for either Gary, Hammond, or East Chicago?
You know, part of it is we have to we're talking about cities that are closer to the state line. I mean, Hammond is right there on the state line. We have to make it so that people can reach it. You know, there's some economic factors that are involved in this. And you have to keep in mind, not everyone can jump in a car and drive 30 minutes. You know, that doesn't work out very well for all people. So something that is close, something that is convenient, something that is reachable. Otherwise, it won't have the maximum input and won't have the maximum amount of help.
All right, Representative, thank you so much. That's all I needed, unless there's something else you need to say or get across.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a big factor for us that there's a lot of other counties in the state that have permanent testing sites, and we don't. Again, we are the second highest county in terms of positive tests, in terms of deaths. You know, we know that the influence of the Chicago area is affecting that in terms of either people coming over. I'll give you an example. I work out at a gym in Hammond, and, you know, I've had people that, you know, I work out with have pointed out to me there are more Illinois plates than Indiana plates sometime at the gym. And then also the huge amount of people that are live in Northwest Indiana that go over to Chicago. I believe it's like 35,000 residents. So you have a lot of crossing of people, and we want to make sure that there's free testing that's set up to make sure that we keep it safe. We know that testing, along with masks, along with social distancing, are a big part of what we need to do to slow down and hopefully, you know, sooner than later, eliminate the effects of COVID. So anything we can do to protect the citizens of Northwest Indiana, the people in my district, my area, in Lake County, that's something that I want to work on.
All right.
Hey, can I add something else?
Sure, go ahead.
I need to also highlight is we know that, you know, my district 2 in Lake County, we have a high number of minorities, and we know that there's been a huge impact on the Black and Latino communities. And so when you also add on factors of why it would be important to have, why it is important to have a permanent testing site in Lake County, that also adds to it.
All right. Okay,
Representative. I mean, we've had a lot of conversation clearly about systemic racism and the impact on healthcare. So this fits into things that we're working on and trying to improve every day.
And that is Indiana State Representative Earl Harris Jr. And when we come back, a conversation about Hammond history. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. When I say state line slaughterhouse, do you know what that's referring to? What if I told you that's an early name to the city of Hammond? Well, it is, and that's not all. Did you also know that Germans came here by the droves in the 1840s? A 19th century historian named Alfred Andreas described the city as, quote, an unbroken forest of heavy timber, but which also has long since disappeared under the aggressive civilization of the white man's axe. That's a passage from the new 204-page book called Lost Hammond, Indiana, published by the History Press based in Charleston, South Carolina. The author is Joseph S. Pete, award-winning reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Joseph, welcome to Off Mic here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
Thank you. Joseph, the first question I have for you, and it's probably going to be pretty tough for you to answer, and I don't mean to stump you, but that we often see your byline in the Times. You often have two, three, sometimes four stories in one day. How did you find time to write this book?
Oh, well, I write by day and I write by later at night. I do cover a wide array of beats for the Times, a lot of the business and art stuff, but after a long day of writing, I like to unwind by going home and writing more. So I just worked on it in evenings, mostly evenings over the course of about a year. I spent a lot of the research at Indiana University Northwest's Calumet Regional Archives and at the Susan Long Local History Room at the Hammond Public Library. They're open on the evenings on Wednesdays, and I was there pretty much every Wednesday for a while doing research and scanning a lot of the photos that were involved in the book. It has nearly 94 historic black and white photos, ranging from dramatic shots of like early ice harvests at Wolf Lake to more contemporary shots of more contemporary shots, but a lot of the history is documented through the photos in the book as well.
Well, let me ask you, Joseph, where did you, first of all, how long did it take you to write this book?
Oh, it was about a year. It was roughly about a year. I've always had an interest in writing. I was born in Hammond at St. Margaret's. I grew up like in Highland, just outside the city, often spent a lot of time there as a kid. We went to the Hammond Civic Center a lot for like the boxing, I'd walk to Woodmore Mall. Frequented the bookstore there quite a bit. Spent a lot of time in the city, Wolf Lake, hiking around there. And I've always had an interest in, I'm a journalist by day, but my long-term interest has always kind of been in writing books. And I've particularly been interested in writing about Northwest Indiana and its history. I just feel like we're a very storied, historic place that often kind of gets overlooked. We're a no man's land between Chicago and Indiana. We're not really fully accepted or embraced by either. But there's like just a ton of rich history here. You've had a lot of prominent historic figures, you know, who come through the area, Gene Shepard, Scholl, Orville Redenbacher, Alva Roebuck, and we've had a great impact on society. Octave Chanute helped invent flight here. You know, the steel we made at our mills, it's gone to build, you know, countless cars and washing machines, countless bridges, a lot of the notable architecture of the 20th century. The Sears Tower, the St. Louis Arch, Touchdown Jesus at Notre Dame, all built with either Regent Steel or Regent Know-How, the John Hancock Center, the Houston Astrodome. The region has just had a huge impact on our nation, but it often just doesn't get its full appreciation and due. And I've just had an interest about writing books about the region and kind of telling its story.
Well, that's true. It doesn't get its due. But let me ask you this. What was that impetus, though? And obviously, you take a lot of notes. You cover a lot of things throughout Northwest Indiana. And you said you were born in Hammond. What was that sort of the epiphany where you said, you know what, I need to write a book on all this?
Oh, I was initially approached. I was pitched by the History Press about potentially writing a book. They had seen some of my journalism. And they do this Lost series where there's a series of another local journalist, Jerry Davich, you're obviously familiar with. He wrote Lost Gary a couple years ago. But they've done Lost books about kind of bygone or faded institutions from across the from cities and communities across the country. I wanted to celebrate Hammond's history in this book, though. I also wanted to take great pains as to not just make it kind of a, strictly about faded or bygone institutions, especially in the Rust Belt and not just in Northwest Indiana, but in, Ohio and Western Pennsylvania and all these areas. Buffalo, you see a lot of the romanticization of like what was, and the areas kind of get depicted as now like economically depressed wastelands or whatever. And that's not the reality of it. Hammond has certainly evolved and changed over time, but it's by no means like, a husk of its former self or anything. It's still a very lively, vibrant community. And I tried to take pains in the book to kind of present that and show that, Hammond is not just all history. It's still, it still has a future, a bright future, and it's still, there's still quite a bit there today.
That's right.
As a society, we've moved on from a lot of the stuff I write about in the book. Like, you don't have grand downtown department stores, really, in mid-sized cities or much anywhere anymore. You don't have grand movie palaces. They've been replaced by the multiplex. Our kind of entire way of life as a society has changed since what some may perceive as, like, Hammond's heyday or whatever.
That's right. There is a lot of history to Hammond. But, I mean, right off the bat, you find out that the first name of the city was basically known as State Line Slaughterhouse because, as you say in the book, there really wasn't much into Hammond at that point. Why don't you tell us, what was Hammond like in those early years? And we're talking about 1840s or even earlier than that.
Yes. Yeah, it was very rough in those early times. It basically, like, the slaughterhouses in the south side of Chicago were a big industry. And like the steel industry would later do, it basically spilled over from Chicago. They ran out of land. It spilled over into Northwest Indiana. They built George Hammond, an industrialist from Detroit. He ended up building a huge slaughterhouse on basically the state line. It was named State Line Slaughterhouse. That was originally the city's name and what it was known as. That's what the post office was named. That's what the rail yard was named. It was, he tried to make the operations kind of seem impermanent to kind of cheat the railroads out of charging them like too much freight. But originally it was just very rough and tumble. It was pretty much all men who came to work in the slaughterhouse jobs, which were very, dirty and, if they had wives, they would stay in hotels in Chicago. But like for entertainment, the workers, they would have fist fighting, dog fighting, things of that nature. It was just a very like almost Wild West like atmosphere. And it was not the most environmentally friendly business either. You actually had the Grand Calumet River caught on fire the way the Cuyahoga River infamously did in Cleveland, because so much animal fat had spilled into the river that it ended up catching fire at one point.
Well, let me ask you this, Joseph, and I don't know if you have the answer to this or not, but did basically State Line Slaughterhouse, which would become Hammond later on, did it just grow out because they just lost space in Chicago to do more of slaughtering of cattle?
Well, they was looking to build another operation. They were pretty full to capacity. And it ended up, they were scouting for land, and I think they found cheaper land, and it was just a occupation here. And it was one of those, like, you've seen this pattern over and over again in Northwest Indiana, as with U.S. Steel and Albert Gary, and with John Rockefeller and Standard Oil. George Hammond pretty much spent his entire career in Detroit, and he got rich off of his business operation in Hammond. And a lot of that money went, he built, like, the first skyscraper in Detroit. He was one of the original founders of the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is still a very fine cultural institution. but he kind of profited quite a bit off of his operation here until it eventually burned down. He later built a second slaughterhouse in Nebraska, kind of closer to where the cattle are actually raised.
Yeah, you know,
and it was a big operation though, because it was at the time it was the main serving the East Coast with meat. Like a lot of the meat that they processed here, it was sent to the kind of the Boston area. And his big innovation that made it such a large operation was he figured out how to refrigerate meat in a train car, which at the time was help preserve it, because at the time it was very difficult to send it that far. They either had to cure it or they had to, or it wasn't always of the best quality when it got off the train. But he figured out how to, you know, preserve the meat through, via refrigeration over the several days journey out to the New England area.
You know, it's funny because the city of Hammond has a similar history to Gary in that they're both named after people who didn't really spend a lot of time here. You got Albert H. Gary, who obviously the chairman of the U.S. Steel, set up his steel company here in Gary. And then you have George Hammond, who probably better known for helping building up Detroit.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's our area has been so shaped by industrialists and heavy industry, and just a lot of them were never, barely had a toe in the community. They weren't really invested in it in any kind of personal way. It was just a business operation for them. But our area has been defined by, you know, its steel mills and its oil refineries and its institutions. And the book delves into a lot of that. It delves into a lot of the bygone factory operations that Hammond had. W.B. Conkey plant, it was once made, most of the books in the country were once manufactured for a long time in Hammond. The Indiana Botanical Society was a huge herbalist thing that distributed herbs all over the world. You had player pianos that were produced here, chains. All Hammond produced so many different products, you know, tanks during the war, train cars. It never had like the giant steel mills like Gary or East Chicago or, you know, Portage, but it did have a wide array of industry that did contribute quite a bit to the nation.
Well, let me ask you this. The book is called Lost Hammond, Indiana. It's written by award-winning Northwest Indiana Times reporter Joseph S. Pete. Now, let's talk about some of the things that I found really interesting. Things that have been lost that aren't there anymore. Things that, you know, people may not have, first of all, the one thing I do find interesting, you alluded to, is that we think about the Great Chicago Fire, but you had sort of the Great Hammond Fire that, for all intents and purposes, actually knocked out what you were saying, George Hammond and his big time cattle operation. But that's not the only thing. There's a lot of things that got lost in other big fires in Hammond in the early 19th century, well, the early 20th century.
Oh, absolutely. That was not uncommon at the time, too. It was very difficult for fire departments to operate. They didn't have the infrastructure they have now. They're, you know, using pretty primitive means to put out fires, but the slaughterhouse did burn down. And at the time, it seemed like the end of the world to Hammond, because it destroyed, you know, most of the city at the time was like limited housing. The Hessville area was being settled separately, but the area, you know, it was a lot of housing and everything was pretty much built up around the factory. But the city had started to grow to the point at that point where the W.B. Conkey plant was already, you know, close to opening. And, they had, the economy was beginning to finally diversify where it wasn't just kind of a one slaughterhouse town. And so the plant was unfortunately never rebuilt. But honestly, that probably ended up being beneficial. Because slaughterhouses, you know, there was a reason it was built in the middle of nowhere, because, you know, they're very noxious fumes. There's a lot of emissions, spills into the water, you know, for quality of life reasons. They it probably helped Hammond's growth, actually, that it did burn down, because, you know, people don't want to live right next to a giant slaughterhouse. It's just, you know, an unpleasant neighbor, I guess.
Even now. Well, yes. You know, Joseph, we're going to skip over some of the stuff that I'm really interested in, and I just found fascinating. Things like, you know, Wolf Lake being known as the gangland graveyard, and dumping bodies for Al Capone and some of the people he rubbed out, and Leopold and Loeb. If you want to read that, you can read it in the book. But I'm more interested, let's say, about something I didn't know about, the Knickerbocker Ice Company that used to set up shop on Wolf Lake. What did you learn about them?
Yes, actually, those are some of my favorite photos from the book, too, because they're some of the most historic. But the in the days before refrigeration, it wasn't just Hammond, too. It was also, there were similar operations in, like, Hobart and LaPorte, I believe. But before they had electrified refrigeration, they pretty much had to use ice for the ice box or whatever. And then Northwest Indiana being right, you know, and Hammond being right up against, like, Michigan, there's a lot of kind of, like, shallow residual lakes that the glaciers left behind, and Hammond, prominently Wolf Lake. And it's a, you know, very large lake, stretches into Chicago, very shallow lake, but it was a, at the time, it was one of the early commercial drivers too. You had, some people were there, they were fishing and they were, you know, on shacks on the lake and selling people, you know, a mess of fish for 15 cents and hunting and trapping. And, but one of the big early operations that went there is when they started harvesting ice. They would go out into the winter onto the frozen surface of the lake and just carve out blocks of ice that were in turn sold to people to, you know, for their ice boxes at home. And it was a pretty significant operation there. They were, I think at one point, let me check on this. But at one point, they were able to produce roughly the equivalent of like 5 billion ice cubes, and it would have been enough to supply 56 drinks a year for every person in the United States at the time. It was just a pretty, it evolved into a pretty major operation.
Well, let me ask you something, and I hope I'm pronouncing it right, because I had never heard of this. And that's one of the things I love about, you know, I'll digress just for a little bit. But, you know, a lot of people could say, well, I'm from this city or I grew up in this city. But you don't really know your city until you research it and learn the history. I grew up in East Chicago, but just being from there, yeah, you may know the last 20 or 30 years, but the town has been around for about 100 years. So there's nothing like being a reporter and having forced or maybe by through love having to do research on your hometown. So I had never heard of this. The Robie horse track or the Robie horse track.
Yeah, that was very interesting. Northwest Indiana and Hammond especially have long had a history of like kind of drawing people over the state line with vice, whether that's cheap cigarettes or fireworks that are legal in Illinois. Or, you know, the predecessor to the Horseshoe Casino was gaming, has been in Northwest Indiana for a very long time. The Robie was initially an entirely separate town from Hammond that later kind of got annexed into it. It's like literally right up at the state line with Chicago. It's that area, you know, right by the border. Today, it's kind of near Five Points. You have the Horseshoe and the Unilever plant and Cargill and all that up there. But it was originally like a very, they had racetracks, they had horse tracks initially, and then they had racetracks, and there was a lot of gambling at the time. And they were able to kind of preserve that by bribing a lot of local officials in Hammond and Crown Point.
Not in Hammond, come on.
Oh, yeah. it was known as...
really? Bribing? Unheard of.
The politics were described as like Robie-ized, where they had their tentacles and everything like locally. But it got so bad to the point you had traffic was lined up down from Chicago to take part in like these illegal, you know, gambling operations. But it got so bad that the governor of Indiana at the time actually sent in the National Guard to break everything up. But then later it became that they put in like racing tracks, and it was kind of like a training ground for the Indianapolis 500. A lot of the drivers who go on to race there ended up racing at the Robie Speedway. And the book kind of cites this very cool Jane Shepherd story where he had, I don't remember if he had written about it or if it was from one of his radio shows, but he described kind of going to Robie as a kid with his father. And it was just kind of an interesting, evocative story. I get to quote him a few times in there. He had another great story about the plate giveaway at the Orpheum Theater that I thought was highly entertaining. And I quote a little bit of that to pay him his due.
There's so many things that are in this book. They're just chock full of history, of things that are lost, literally lost in Hammond, Indiana. They're no longer around. One of the things that, I had never heard of, and I hope I'm pronouncing it right, the Athi Athay Hydro Amusement Park.
Oh, yes, that was one of the big attractions. Five Points almost used to be kind of the center of the universe. They used to have multiple attractions and theme parks and roller coasters there by, and of course, the Fish Palaces, Phil Schmitz and Vogels. And it was just like the center for dining and entertainment in the area. The Athney was very short-lived, but it was very memorable because they were trying to put a kind of water attractions on Wolf Lake to kind of draw visitors in. And it ended up backfiring because the people were kind of besieged by mosquitoes. So what I thought, what a really amusing anecdote from the book in there is the owners tried to remedy this by going over to the Standard Oil refinery. And keep in mind, this was in the early 20th century. And there were very lax environmental laws at the time, but they got barrels of gasoline and then poured it into the lake to try to suppress the mosquitoes. And but their business just plan didn't end up working out. They weren't able to consistently draw people and ended up kind of shortly going out of business. But you had a lot of attractions there back in the day, like the Hammond Beach Inn. And there was the longest wooden roller coaster in the world was there. At the Five Points intersection, it was a huge hub.
And there's something called there was Madura's Dance Land and Boardwalk Park. Let me ask you this: in your research or in doing this, were you able to talk to anybody who remembers some of those things?
The book is more focused on published accounts. I did do a few interviews, but I tried to focus more on. I used extensively newspaper research, a lot of local archives from the Times and the Post Tribune, but the Chicago Tribune, a lot of defunct newspapers like the Whiting Sun, but also my course of my research took me to include papers as far away as like the Boston newspapers in Boston, because the infamous gangster Whitey Bulger turned out to have robbed his first bank and first come to the FBI's attention while he was in Hammond. But a lot of it is upon newspaper research and previously published books. I tried to use already published sources for most of it.
It does seem like Northwest Indiana was either the training ground for so many gangsters, close and far, Al Capone, John Dillinger. Now you're telling me Whitey Bulger. So the book is called Lost Hammond, Indiana. It's written by Joseph Pete. The one thing, there are a lot of things that have been lost, but do we know what is still like the oldest building, say, in downtown Hammond? I know the Little Red Schoolhouse in Hessville is one of those things, but something in downtown.
Oh, in downtown. I don't know what the longest standing one would be. Some of them date back, like Bank Calumet and the Yale buildings. Some of those are, it could be P.H. Mueller's, maybe. There are quite a few, but the Mueller Hardware Store, which is now an art gallery, that dates back to the 19th century, and it's been pretty well preserved. But that's kind of the story of Hammond, though, in a way, because for a long time it was a hardware store serving the downtown population, and eventually that wasn't viable. Too many people had moved to like more suburban areas in the south of the city, or even out of the city, and people were going to like Ace Hardware or more corporate hardware stores. And then, but the owners managed to turn into an art gallery, evolve it. Now it has very popular open mic nights. They have live musical acts. It's, like Hammond, like Northwest Indiana, it found a way to adapt, to survive, to, stay strong and kind of move on and adapt to changing times and circumstances.
Well, Joseph, let me ask you this. Did you have a good time writing this? And what's the one thing that you learned in writing this historical thing that you really didn't know and found fascinating?
Oh, well, one was the early history of professional sports in Hammond. I wasn't aware of. I had vaguely known that Hammond had had an NFL team, the Hammond Pros, but there were several Hall of Famers who played for them. They never really played a home game in Hammond, though. They played their home games at it wasn't called Wrigley Field at the time, but it was at what was now known as Wrigley Field. But they played mostly away games in kind of the fledgling days of the NFL. But most of the small market teams, with the exception of the Green Bay Packers, were since ended up being drummed out of the league. But it was in the early days, you had a lot of mid-sized cities had their own NFL teams. But Hammond also had several basketball teams too, in precursors to the National Basketball Association in the early days. And I didn't know it had been such a hub for professional sports.
You know, there. I mean, I just had a ball reading some of the passages in this book. Things like the Hammond Beach Inn. Of course, you have things that we didn't. You even have Empress Casino. Now, people might say, "Oh, yeah, everybody remembers a casino because it's right there." But what's there? That's $500 million thing on a barge. You know, the precursor to that was the Empress Casino, and we kind of forget that.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, that was one of the things I really tried to do with it, because early on I was at the Calumet Regional Archives, and James Lane, the historian, brought up that he wasn't particularly fond of like books like Lost, the Lost series, because, you know, they tried to present a place as like done and over and its glory days are behind it. So I was really just trying to take pains to with some things like the casino is still there under a different brand and everything, but to tell the history and show how it has evolved into the current day, and not just write, like, you know, I don't want to present Hammond as like in any way writing it off as like a city of faded glory or whatever. Because you see a lot of those narratives, especially with Gary, where it's, you know, there's still a ton of people who live there. There are people who live there. They have dreams. They have aspirations. They have lives. They're people like anyone else. And there's no reason that they should be like just dismissed like carte blanche, which some people have a tendency to do. So it was very important to me to just try to draw the through lines and show that Hammond, of course, has a very rich history, but it's still vital in the present day. And, you know, things have adapted and changed over time. And I definitely wanted to include the Empress, though, because ever since I was a kid, I liked the stories about when they legalized the casino gambling, because they had that whole pretense where it had to be, it was riverboat gambling. And the state was like very insistent upon that, you know, in the early days, to the point where that one casino in southern Indiana, where it's by that hotel, like they built a man-made lake, so it would technically be a riverboat. But in Lake Michigan, people would wait on the piers in the winter when it was frozen, because under state law, it had to be, you couldn't gamble unless it was out at sea. Like there were different maritime rules that applied to like gaming. And then, you know, and it's just funny over time that that's been relaxed to the point where now you can, as long as you're anywhere within the state of Indiana, you can go on one of their sportsbook apps and bet on even like Ukrainian ping pong on your phone. But I just like the story. I just like the image and the story of the people like waiting outside, you know, waiting to get on the boat, even though it was frozen in place at Lake Michigan. It was docked. It wasn't going anywhere, but they were waiting for it to like return in an hour from its voyage, because that's what the state law mandated.
You know, I don't know if you have any information on there, but I remember the precursor to when all the casinos went there. They had right out the Hammond Marina something called the Milwaukee Clipper, this little boat. And I really used to enjoy going there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was actually, I don't know if that photo is in that. The Clipper was one of the photos that was supposed to be in the book, but it might have ended up being cut out because there were some that didn't meet, like, you know, when you're dealing with historic photos, sometimes they'll be creased or sometimes, you know, but there'll be various like issues related to publication as far as the resolution and everything.
You know,
I think I had even pitched that for the cover, but it was, they prefer black and white and it was in color.
You know, even when you're writing a book like this, you still have to cut things out, because I'm sure you just got so much information that not everything can be in a book. And even like recent things that have been lost. And I just think, oh, well, everybody remembers this. But for now, like a generation, they'll never remember Woodmar Mall. I mean, Woodmar Mall was a thriving, it wasn't as big as South Lake Mall, but definitely a one-story mall that had a lot of shops. You had Carson Perry Scott's. It's no longer there. And really, for what, the last 10, 15 years, you only just had the Carson's building there. That's now cleared away. You got the big Hammond Sports Complex, but you know, Woodmar Mall was there for a long time. I worked there. I know a lot of people who used to work there, and that's gone. And for like a whole generation, they're never going to know what was there before.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I've always wished too, they would at least put the sign back up there just to kind of pay homage to it or do something with the sign, the way the Goldblatt's clock is at the Hammond Library, you know, in some way display it because it was so iconic. But too, that mall was actually very significant, because it was one of the first like enclosed malls. It was originally outdoor mall, but it was one of the first like enclosed in the United States. And it was designed by the Austrian architect, Victor Guerin, who was very influential in, he designed a lot of the early and first malls in the country. And that was kind of why you had some quirks and eccentricities in the design. Like you'd have hallways that really led to nowhere, you know, instead of doors or looping around. But it was because it was a kind of an almost an early prototype. But he grew to end up hating the influence he had. And he said, like, right before his death that he hoped every mall would be torn down. And he kind of did get his wish with the Woodmar Mall. But I have such fond memories of going there as a kid. I used to walk to go to that bookstore that would serve, like, the Purdue Cal kids. And then, you know, I remember playing the arcade there as a kid and the neon Woodmar sign and the Court of Turtles. And it's funny, too, yep. because that ended up displacing Woodmar helped kill and River Oaks helped kill a lot of the downtown retail that was, you know, had been a big regional draw at the time. But it ended up where Woodmar and River Oaks and malls generally have been, you know, on the decline for years. Just ever as time passes, people's habits and change and there's no, you know, turning back, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Now, so you're telling me something I didn't even know. I did not know Woodmar Mall was an outdoor mall. I knew River Oaks was because I worked at River Oaks Mall in Calumet City before when it was an outdoor mall. And I don't think I worked there when it transitioned to an indoor mall. And I think, I think that's what it lost kind of its appeal. I thought River Oaks was great as an outdoor mall, but I guess maybe a lot of their revenue went down once winter came and everything. And here's another thing before we get into that. I think a lot of, I didn't know this, West Hammond. Tell us about yes. West Hammond. And I think a lot of Cal City people aren't going to like this.
Oh, absolutely. Well, oh, wait, just on Woodmar very briefly, because one of my, another old photo that ended up not getting used, but was probably the favorite photo I came across in research, was when Woodmar Mall had first opened, there was a shot of, because Santa, that one of the big things at Woodmar is they always had Santa, but in the early days, they're trying to generate excitement and bring in people. And so they'd have Santa come in on a helicopter of all things. And then there was this excellent, excellent photo of a WJOB reporter with like an old microphone where it was, he had the kind of like the suitcase to record it. And he was recording, he was interviewing Santa and the mayor with a helicopter in the backdrop, but it's just the resolution was way too small to end up in the book. But it was quite an image. But yes, on River or Calumet City was West Hammond originally, and it was you've seen that a lot in the region too. Like with Lake Station was originally Lake Station as a train station, then East Gary, then they decided to rebrand back, and it's. But originally, you know, a lot of the vice was across the state line. You had a lot of the factory workers were over here, and then that's where. They developed a lot of the dens of iniquity, and they'd have stage girls and prostitution and things of that nature, and a lot of like not speakeasies or saloons, but you know it was known as the Strip in Cal City. It was very infamous for many years, and but originally it was West Hammond, and I don't recall offhand why they decided to end up ultimately rebranding it, but it was rebranded, and yeah.
It always feels like towns that are west, you know, towns that are named after the major city, they always seem not to be a great area for some reason. So, I don't know why that is, except maybe for West Chicago. They're okay. But North Chicago, East Chicago, East St. Louis never works out well for the smaller nickname town.
Yeah, maybe you need to forge your own identity. I don't. Yeah, it's or New Chicago too. They never.
So what are some of the? I'm looking at. I mean, there's literally so many things in this book that one of the things I got to say out there too. I really think if you're somebody from Hammond or Northwest Indiana, there's so many local history books. You mentioned Jerry Davich's book. But there are other books, too, that I kind of think it should be required reading for high schools, grade schools, or at least, you know, maybe for a semester or something for people to get to know their history. There's so much history in this area that people forget about it. People forget about the role it's played in the Industrial Revolution, the good and bad, of course, everything from Standard Oil the steel mills, of course, the industry, but we haven't even gotten to, I mean, you've written a lot about, of course, the demise of Sears, but one of the partners in there, Roebuck, got his start in Hammond or had a connection to Hammond. And so a lot of people forget about this. I hope people get a chance to read Lost Hammond, Indiana. It's fun. I mean, it's just not about all the buildings that are no longer there, but about the history, some of the gangster times. We kind of knew this area was like that, but it, just to see it in print like that and go, you forget certain things and things you just never knew about, like the Knickerbocker Ice Company and stuff like that. So you really did a great job on this book, and I know you've had a couple of book signings. Do you have any other book signings coming up? I know with COVID-19, it's got to be tough.
Oh, yeah. No, it's very surreal experience releasing a book during the pandemic. We did do a signing at Miles Books. They still have signed copies. We did it outdoors and like with masks and social distancing and everything. But a lot of the bookstores haven't even been open. So it's been it's certainly been a challenge and a unique experience. But Miles Books in downtown Highland has signed copies. I think it's there, and they will also deliver across the country, or mail it across the country or deliver. I think their number is 219-838-8700. But they've been good because they were more or less one of the few bookstores that's been open through this whole thing. Green Door Books is finally opening up on Friday in Hobart. I'm very excited about that. As a longtime patron of them, they have got a good zine library there, great local art. They do many high quality events. They have dollar books too. I highly recommend them, but they're, you know, unfortunately we don't have as many bookstores as we once did in the region, but I strongly encourage people to read and to read up on local history.
Well, Joseph Pete is a writer, reporter, award-winning writer, reporter for the Northwest Indiana Times. He's the author of Lost Hammond, Indiana. And Joseph, thank you so much for being here on Off Mic.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
And that is all the time we have for today's Off Mic. I'd like to thank all my guests, and I'd like to wish you a very safe and happy 4th of July weekend. I'm Michael Puente. You can hear me the rest of the week on WBEZ. Thank you again for all of us at Lakeshore Public Media. Have a great 4th of July weekend.